Coming up today, airport authorities are banning uncharged mobile devices from planes, J.K. Rowling has written a short Harry Potter story, and smart light bulbs have a worrying security vulnerability. We'll also be talking about Fitbits for your lady bits, and whether Google is trying to get the right to be forgotten retracted. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to child stalking, wearables and inconvenient airport security measures. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
Now, I just have to make a little admission that we've just half recorded the podcast once, and Liat astutely noted that I hadn't turned the recording device on, so forgive us if the first half of this podcast sounds somewhat rehearsed, because it is. But it's worth flagging before we get into the news that we have a great new magazine issue. It's the August issue, and on the front cover you will see a menacing looking gorilla ape.
With come to bed eyes, I think, actually.
Oh, I think menacing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interchangeable for some people.
But anyway, the cover story relates to Andy Serkis, who plays Gollum in Lord of the Rings and is currently heavily involved in the new Planet of the Apes movies. Now, he, as you may or may not know, is this kind of motion capture actor, director extraordinaire. He's kind of revolutionized the way that we do this kind of very intricate forms of motion capture, and he has an amazing studio called the Imaginarium, and we have had some incredible behind the scenes access, so there's a great story there. So I'd heartily recommend that you buy the printed version of the Wired.co.uk website, or you can download it in something called an app, so we've heard. But let's get on with the news. Now, airport security is already a bit of a faff. You have to jump through a number of different hoops, including only carrying 100 mils of shampoo, because obviously that's a massive security risk. But it's just been taken up a notch with a new decision around uncharged electronics. Liat.
Yes, this is potentially the biggest inconvenience you are going to face in the airport, apart from when you forget your sandwich before security and have to buy another one. Anyway, this is all because of fears identified by US intelligence services. The Secretary of Homeland Security made an announcement that we'd be expecting enhanced measures because of intelligence suggesting that a branch from Syria, a terrorist group connected with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, have been devising, or perhaps even have devised bombs, they didn't go into it, that can pass through airport security and don't contain metal. This has all come down to never go to an airport again with an electronic device that is not charged, or you face having to bin it along with your bottle of water over 100 mils.
That is absolutely ridiculous. Like, so what happens if you get to security and you don't, you know, you happen to have forgotten your charger while you're on a holiday and you're getting back onto the plane and you can't charge it? You get to airport security, that you can't power it up. They don't have chargers just handy available to you. So what do? You can't just chuck it in the bin along with the water bottles, can you?
Well, a few days after this announcement was made, I think, you know, chaos ensued and people panicked because people are lazy and they don't charge their devices. And airline authorities came out with basically recommendations for, we will give you the chance to turn around and go to a technology store in the airport and perhaps they will be able to charge your device. Or alternatively, you can use one of the overpriced services, apparently, that a lot of people use already, where you can send things home once you've gone, you know, to that stage through airport security. Okay. Which I didn't know about, but apparently this is a kind of common service whereby anything else that you're carrying, I don't know, your knives and bombs,
or your expensive perfume or some.
Well, for that I knew, but yeah, I guess, okay, so perfume that's over 100 mils. So yeah, this must be a service for those frustrated people there that are standing there with brand new mountains of expensive perfume.
Yeah.
It happens a lot, I guess, when you're going via somewhere. It's happened to me a few times when you're changing airports and at the second airport you have to bin all the suntan lotion you've bought at the first.
Okay. Well, don't they sometimes seal them into bags and kind of pass them through?
Nope.
No. Okay. But anyway, we're digressing slightly. So this is this going to start already? Have we already got to think about this and if we're going on holidays in the next few weeks?
I mean, yes. I think there's going to be obviously a bit of leeway in between because we all know about it, but I'm sure the whole nation does not. But they've been edging towards this for weeks. Nick Clegg has said this is, you know, security is an evolving thing. We're going to have to roll with the punches, guys. But yeah, absolutely. And I think the general consensus from any British spokespeople have been, this is something we really need. It's unavoidable. Get with it, people. We've become a bit complacent. It doesn't mean there's, you know, present dangers there now.
Mm. So the challenge to terrorists now is to develop a bomb that can fit within a device that can also power up on request.
Liv, yeah. Don't tell them.
I imagine that has crossed their mind already.
Yeah. The UK has actually yesterday, from when you're listening to this, announced the world has to also do this for us. Any flights coming to the UK or leaving the UK will have to abide by these same rules.
I'm interested to see whether that will actually happen, because I know when I've been through airport security at foreign airports before, they haven't been very strict about the, you know,
getting the laptop out.
Yeah, and also, you know, with liquids as well. Mm. They haven't insisted that they be in a bag. They haven't checked.
So I guess the recommendation would be to make sure your devices are charged when you go on holiday and when you come back from holiday, crucially. So if you don't have a converter plug, you better get one. This week, there was a lot of excitement about some new Harry Potter content. I thought it was over, but Katie, apparently it's not quite.
It's not. Harry Potter is back. It's been 7 years since the last book was published, which I couldn't quite believe. But he is back in a new story that's available on the online portal for everything Harry Potter, which is called Pottermore. This new content comes in the style of a news article by the journalist Rita Skeeter, who is a kind of semi-evil character who manipulates people's words and...
Ooh, it bites, doesn't
yeah,
it?
And has always been a bit mean about Harry and has kind of published lots of horrible things about him. And she's reporting from the Quidditch World Cup in Patagonia.
Obviously.
Because that's the obvious place that you would hold a Quidditch World Cup, I guess. But just to recap, let's remember what happened just at the end of the last Harry Potter book. So Harry and Ginny were married, and Ron and Hermione were married, and they were all putting their kids on the Hogwarts Express and waving them off into the distance. Mm. So that's where we left the story.
You've literally just ruined it for me, by the way.
Well, you've had 7 years, Leah. Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah, so next up we're going to ruin like Othello for you or something, or Romeo and Juliet.
No, that's actually good literature. Let's not get into that.
Oh dear, boom. Yes. So what have we learned from this new story?
So here's what we've found out about Harry. He's about to turn 34 and he's starting to go grey.
I empathise.
Yeah, so I guess this could be called Harry Potter and the Midlife Crisis or something, but he's not quite there yet, but he's going grey.
I mean, I'm not far off 34. So.
Your hair is a beautiful, striking blonde, though.
And anyway, so Harry is a famous Auror, and he always aspired to be an Auror, which, if you don't know, is a kind of sort of magic policeman / detective / military person who goes around fighting evil. It's a sort of a spy as well.
But a badass wizard spy.
A badass wizard spy, indeed. So he's fulfilled his ambition of becoming an Auror, and he is an Auror, and he still wears his iconic round glasses he wore at school. And he's got another scar. So we already knew that he had the scar on his forehead, the lightning bolt, but he's now got a mysterious mark over his right cheekbone.
Gosh,
and we're not given any information about how he got this. And Rita Skeeter doesn't know, but she speculated.
Ah, that old Rita.
Harry's wife, Ginny, has also become a journalist, something which Rita Skeeter is clearly quite jealous of, because Ginny's been sent to report on the Quidditch World Cup, whereas Skeeter is just the gossip columnist. Harry's best friends, Ron and Hermione, they are still married. Ron was an Auror, but then left. Maybe he wasn't quite up to the job, which, knowing Ron, it might not be a huge surprise. Hello, Ron.
Harry has another scar. He doesn't sound like he's doing a great job to me.
Well, you know, we don't know what he's fighting Lee at.
Yeah.
Could be really dangerous. So he's now running Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. And Hermione is still working at the Ministry of Magic. She is the head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, and she's tipped from even higher job at the Ministry, which I suspect means that one day she might become Minister of Magic, which is basically Prime Minister, just in case you didn't know.
Wowza.
I know. Neville Longbottom has become a popular teacher of Herbology at Hogwarts. Luna Lovegood is married and has twin sons. And Lupin and Tonks' son, Teddy, is Harry's 16-year-old godson, and he's half werewolf and has bright blue hair. Apparently, he spends a lot of time kissing Bill and Fleur Weasley's beautiful blonde daughter, Victoire. So that's what we know.
There are some amazing details in there. I mean, in your opinion, is this kind of paving the way for another book, or are we definitely over? Is that chapter closed?
Well, I don't know, because this is such a tease, and for Harry Potter fans, it's wonderful in one respect, because they are desperate to kind of glean any information about what happens to Harry afterwards, according to J.K. Rowling. But at the same time, to hear it all coming through filtered by Rita Skeeter, and not actually hear, because a lot of the book is sort of narrated by you can hear what's kind of going on in Harry's head, and you can hear what he's thinking, and not to be able to know any of that is really frustrating. And there's that mystery about his new scar. So perhaps something. Fingers crossed.
So if you want to read it, how can you do that?
So you can read it by signing up to Pottermore if you haven't already, and they'll probably force you to be sorted into a house first of all. I'm in Gryffindor. And
you're so proud of that.
And you can progress to the content. And it kind of, when I signed into Pottermore yesterday, it just popped up as the first thing on the screen. So there you go.
So the next piece of news is an amazing experiment that you wrote about, Liat, which suggests that man, or mankind perhaps, is really bad at being bored.
Actually, you were quite right with man.
Man.
Yeah. This is possibly my favourite story of the entire month, because we now know, thanks to science, that when men sit alone in a room with nothing to do but press a button that they know administers a painful electric shock, they will choose to press that button more often than not.
So hang on, how long are they being kept in this room? I can imagine you might want some stimulation if you're in there for hours on end.
Yeah, I mean, me too. But 15 minutes, Liv, tops. That's the top end. It's between 6 and 15 minutes, all these experiments, and they could not hack it. So this has essentially led us to speculate about whether men would rather be electrocuted than think, than be left with their own thoughts. Horror.
For a mere quarter of an hour.
Yeah. So we can thank a team of psychologists from the University of Virginia and Harvard University for this. They began this wonderful journey by pondering, do people enjoy sitting with their own thoughts? And that magical journey led them to this. But they're not malicious people. They didn't go straight out with just shocking people. They really wanted to find out, you know, what we enjoy as human beings, okay. Whether we like to think.
I suppose it was the choice between choosing nothing or an unpleasant experience. They kind of had to make it that, didn't they?
Well, that was only when they found out that people just don't like sitting in a room thinking. They went through a whole host of experiments where people would have to sit in an empty room for between 6 and 15 minutes, and then they all reported they did not like it and it was hard to concentrate.
Mm.
Okay, so then they extended it for anyone up to age 77, because I think first it was college students. Same thing happened. Then they were allowed to do it at home. They thought, you know, they're in the comfort of their own home. They're not being watched and probed by lab people. They're not in some weird, creepy room in the university. Same thing. Everyone admitted, or pretty much everyone admitted, to cheating by picking up their phones or leaving their chairs, which they obviously felt guilty about, because that was a direct quote from the book. All of this, 15 minutes, was the peak that they were asked to do this. So, you know, they thought, okay, people really don't like this. You know, maybe we'll give them an alternative. So they gave them music. They had the option to sit and listen to music or read, but not communicate. And everyone said they found it easier to concentrate and they enjoyed it more.
Okay.
Which I think is kind of ridiculous, because of course you're going to concentrate more because you've been told to concentrate on something, music.
Well, yeah, I guess it makes sense, definitely.
So basically, they used this winding road as an excuse to shock strangers, finally. This was the, I think, 11th experiment, or they then did a series of electric shock experiments, but it took 11 in total to come to this conclusion. And they found that 12 out of 18 men, which is 67%, chose to press the button they knew would shock them, rather than sitting and doing nothing.
And just to clarify, they did know what they were going to get by pressing the button. It wasn't like a surprise. They had a big red button saying press me, and it was just too
taunting
tempting
them. No, this is my favorite bit of the entire study, because all of them had already experienced a shock, and they had all, when they were asked, said that they would pay to not experience that shock again.
But I guess it turned out how much they pay not to experience the 15 minutes of boredom either.
Yes. And apparently they just pay £1 million for that. They just don't like it.
Wowza.
My other favourite bit is that although on average these guys did it 1.47 times in that 15 minute period, one person did it a whopping 190 times.
Wow.
So that's a masochist right there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe just really, really bored. And ADHD.
How about women?
Women, well, I mean, I don't want to like play this up too much because I'm a woman, but only 6 out of 24 did it.
So only 6 out of 24 women pressed the button to give themselves an electric shock.
Yeah, that's versus 12 out of 18 for the men. So there was a wider pool of women and less women chose to do it.
But some women still did. We can't be, you know, some pat did. Ourselves on the back too much.
I don't know. It's quite a significant amount less.
So what does this tell us?
Well, at this stage, we're not entirely sure, and they plan on investigating it further. But the professors behind it did say they don't think this has anything to do with, you know, modern society and everyone being glued to their electronics and wanting to constantly be stimulated. Okay. and seek some stimulation. You know, they're kind of speculating that human beings are social creatures. We like to engage in the world. And perhaps this has more to do with a lack of spontaneity, which apparently we humans like to engage in. Mm. We like to be able to just do what we want, which makes sense.
I bet people who do meditation would have no problem with this.
Mm, I was just thinking that. Yeah. If you can learn to meditate for 15 minutes, this will seem like a breeze.
Mm.
That's absolutely what they said. They were like, people generally don't have a lot of control over their thoughts unless they've actually actively trained their minds through something like meditation.
And if you want to do that, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about an app called Headspace, and I think there are a few others on there. Katie,
yeah, there's another really good one called Buddhify as well. There are a few different kind of meditation apps out there that actually make it really easy to learn, because it's kind of a difficult skill to pick up on your own. But
and then you too could last 15 minutes without having to electrocute yourself. Now, the final story for this week's podcast relates to a security vulnerability in a smart light bulb. Katie.
Caution. Danger. The Internet of Things is a scary place to be, or at least it's a scary place to be connected to Wi-Fi. So just in case you didn't know already what the Internet of Things is, and I think a lot of the time these days people just sort of presume, it's a trend in which manufacturers add computing and networking capabilities to normal everyday appliances such as light bulbs, which is what we're talking about in this example, so that people can use them remotely using their smartphones or computers, that kind of thing. These white hat hackers, which are the good type of hackers, have devised an attack against network connected light bulbs that exposes Wi-Fi passwords to anyone in the proximity of the LED devices.
So why would you have a smart light bulb in the first place?
So the idea is that you can turn it on and off using your iPhone or Android phone. Either, you know, maybe you've gone out the house and you realise you left your lights on, or just you're sitting on the sofa and you don't want to get up.
Oh, great.
But,
okay.
Yeah, so the particular light bulbs that have been attacked in this case are the LIFX or LIFX smart light bulbs. I'm not sure which one it is, but The researchers basically discovered this weakness that allows hackers, any hacker that's within 30 metres, to obtain the passwords used to secure the local Wi-Fi network. So the credentials are passed from one bulb to another over a sort of a mesh network. Mm. So that's kind of presuming that you've got lots of these light bulbs in your house, I guess. The bulbs used advanced encryption standard to encrypt passwords, which should theoretically protect them, but it turns out that there's an underlying pre-shared key, and this is a cryptography term that means that there's been a password programmed into the light bulb before it's ever been used. Okay. So by the kind of the people that made it, and these passwords were never changed. So once you found out that password, it's really easy to get in there and intercept the Wi-Fi password that's being passed around. And the way that they actually did this was quite remarkable. They had to physically pick the light bulb apart and extract the flash memory from the chip that was inside the light bulb, and then sort of backwards engineer to discover how to attack them. But that they did.
Yeah.
And in all fairness to LIFX, or LIFX, they responded really quickly and closed the loophole. But this is just one example of how these networks in our home are going to be really vulnerable in the future. And, you know, we kind of have a certain expectation of the security in our products these days, mostly from, you know, companies like Apple and Google, who have loads of money to pour research into this and make sure that our products are safe for us. But if everybody, if every manufacturer is just connecting things, then there's a danger that people might be able to crack into our networks.
Yeah, and you think that, you know, okay, a light bulb is not collecting any data about me. It might not be a useful target, but, you know, once someone's on your Wi-Fi network, they can then intercept your communications on your laptop, for example, and, you know, do Wi-Fi sniffing. So it's not that, oh, well, you know, the light bulb hasn't got any valuable data. It's more that it can be that vulnerability that you use to then access something bigger and more lucrative, potentially.
No, I was just thinking about all the things that are under attack. You know, like, I think I mentioned in a piece today about when baby monitors were hacked. That was like one of those things where you thought, how has someone done that? Why is someone doing that? And there was a report released this week on connected cars and how vulnerable they are. And like you say, there's no like uniform standard of protocols that these guys have to pass. So we're all in deep doo-doo.
So that's all the news we have for this week. But still to come, is Google trying to sabotage the right to be forgotten? And why are there so many ridiculous wearables on the market?
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now, the first discussion topic for this week's podcast is going to be the Wired Crystal Ball. And in this, we are predicting that Google is trying to sabotage the right to be forgotten.
Yes, it certainly looks that way, Olivia. I think if anyone's been following the news the last couple of weeks, Google never wanted the so-called right to be forgotten. For anyone unfamiliar with the right to be forgotten, this came out of a clause of the EU Data Protection Directive and relates specifically to a case brought by a Spanish gentleman to the highest court in Europe because he wanted a search result for his name that ranked high up in Google to be removed, basically related to him having financial difficulties in the past and a repossession order. And his argument was that this affected his current prospects and, you know, people will see this as soon as they Google his name. So Europe's highest court agreed. They told Google it had to comply if anyone complains about information that's inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant or excessive in relation to the purposes for which they were processed, which, you know, a lot of people were irked and worried about, particularly Google, because, you know, obviously it's putting them in a position they don't want to be, censoring the web. They've made a lot of noise about how this is effectively making them the center of the web, you know, and something that's maybe irrelevant to one person might be very relevant and pertinent to hundreds, if not thousands, more people. So yeah. It's very hard to implement.
And despite its protests, it launched a tool that allowed you to have links removed.
Yeah, it launched this form a couple of weeks ago with not a great deal of explanation. Then it told us it had tens of thousands of requests, mainly from sex offenders and other awful people trying to get their records scrubbed. So, you know, all scary, scary, scary. Then it started to block really bizarre content in the last week or so. There was a piece by the BBC's Robert Peston, about a former boss of investment bank Merrill Lynch, who had apparently invested recklessly, and that was why he was let go.
And that was obviously a story that is definitely in the public interest.
Yes.
And so it would be extraordinary to remove that, which they did temporarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things that Google went on and on about. You know, this cannot and should not be used to, you know, have people in high ranking positions to protect their reputation and be abused in that manner. But there were also just weird stories, like a Scottish Premier League referee lying about his reasons for granting a penalty. Nobody cares, you know, but perhaps he does. And, you know, all these reports started appearing with no explanation, no course of appeals, and some have since been kind of reversed without really any explanation. And it all just seems very strange for a number of reasons.
Yes, conspiracy theorists are saying that Google is purposefully picking controversial links to remove so that there's public outrage and that somehow we can just forget about the right to be forgotten and, you know, go back to having this open, uncensored web.
Absolutely. I don't even think it's a conspiracy theory. I think they're just doing it because they definitely don't want it. A lot of people don't want it. Everyone knows it's very hard to implement. But it is the law and they're supposed to be doing it now. But the manner in which they're doing it, obviously, you know, big high-profile journalists have had emails sent to them or sent to their news desk saying this is being deleted from our search results. And, you know, a number of the stories that have come out have been from very high-profile national news services who are obviously going to write a story about it.
Yeah.
On top of that, there's just been no transparency. Like, Google is obsessed with transparency. They love it. They're so open and lovely and kind and transparent. Mm-hmm. And they're not telling anyone anything.
Yeah, so we contacted them. I think all three of us have at some point contacted them, asking them to explain their methodology and their process for removing links. And they have continually stonewalled us, saying it's something like a work in progress.
But even more than that, I find they're just kind of behaving like, oh my gosh, this has happened. We didn't know it was going to happen. We are so taken aback. I'm sorry, guys. Bear with us. We're having a lot of trouble here.
Yeah,
we're going to call in some lawyers. Yeah, and they're kind of, everything they've said has been very like kind of bashful and very un-Google. Very kind of, we are just completely lost in the woods with the rest of you, which is to an extent fair enough because it is a really ridiculously hard thing to implement. It feels like they have not really put much effort in at all. Like perhaps they're just saying yes to every single request that comes their way.
And
that's the speculation.
As you pointed out in your article about this, they've kind of known that it was coming for ages. This has been going on for years now.
Yeah.
So it's not like they've had no time to prepare, really.
Yeah, that's what bothers me. All these kind of canned statements like, guys, we can't tell you more because we just didn't, you know, we're so unprepared. Like, why are you unprepared, you massive, massive company that basically runs the internet? Well, you don't run the internet, but you're being asked to now. That's why they hate it.
So what do you think about Google's approach to implementing the right to be forgotten? Do you think that they are trying to forget about this new law? Or do you think that they genuinely have reason to be taking their time over implementing it? And please let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. So the second discussion story is what the actual flip. What the... I want to use this opportunity to discuss extraordinary wearable technology. So guys, I am doing Kegel exercises right now.
Gross. Ooh. Liv.
or wise.
Well, so some of you might be listening thinking, what on earth is a Kegel exercise? Well, it's the thing you do to make the flow of pee stop. Obviously, you don't have to do it. I'm not actually peeing on the podcast. That would be weird. But the same kind of muscles I'm using, called the pelvic floor muscles, that you stop pee with, you can clench and unclench. And guys and girls can do this. Now, the pelvic floor muscles, they stretch between the pubic bone and the tailbone, and they cradle your bladder and your bowels. Although both men and women have them, women's are most likely to be weakened thanks to the wonders of childbirth. And keeping these muscles strong is very important for things like the stability of the pelvic region and the lower spine. And unfortunately, weak muscles in this area can lead to things like incontinence and reduced pleasure, which is, you know, bad news bears for mostly ladies. But there's a new fitness tracker slash piece of wearable tech on the market called the Kegel, which has been described as a Fitbit for your lady bits.
I love this because incontinence isn't like drive enough to do them. We need to share with our friends and have a competition.
Yeah. So basically, imagine it's like a kind of squeezy toy with pressure sensors on it that connects to an app, and you have to kind of put it in, I think you can guess where, clench it, and then it measures how strong your clenches are, and the app then provides you with exercise routines for your lady bits and gives you feedback on how you're doing. Yeah, I don't know if it's about sharing with, you can share with your friends, I think, but that's a bit weird, isn't it?
Well, like, what if you're like embarrassingly weak and you never knew? What if you were like,
well, maybe
what
that's
is this gauge?
Maybe that's a good reason to share.
Definitely.
To find out.
And you can definitely strengthen it. Or is it like that is your pelvic muscle and you can just maintain it?
No, I think you can always strengthen.
You can strengthen any muscle, yeah.
Always strengthen. I wonder how men can strengthen their own pelvic floor muscles.
They not the same way?
No, not well. We wouldn't be able to insert this.
I mean, like the tensing.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Just stop peeing.
But that isn't the only weird piece of wearable tech we've heard about this week. We've also heard about something called the Kizon.
I mean, I don't know how to pronounce this, Liv, but I don't like it.
It's a prison bracelet for children. Essentially, Liat wrote about it this week.
It is, and I guess it's kind of okay. Like, I'm not against losing kids, and I'm all for like making sure you don't lose them, like being very safe. But this is essentially allows parents to listen in on their children. It's for very young children.
Yeah, so it's a bracelet that you wear that has GPS and a microphone and a speaker. It's kind of like actually a miniature mobile phone attached to their wrist.
It's got 2G, 3G enabled, strapped to their wrist, nice and bulky so they don't forget it. Full of bright colours so that they apparently love it.
Yeah.
And there's one button on it, which the kid can press to phone a pre-programmed number. Yeah. And alternatively, the parent can call them. And if the kid doesn't answer, it just goes straight through to their microphone and you can eavesdrop on your kid wherever they are in the world.
Yeah.
It's for very young kids, so fair enough. But, you know, as we were talking in the office about this, where is your child that you need to listen to them randomly?
Yeah, well, you don't
know
where
they are.
Why
aren't they with you?
Or with another responsible adult who you could probably call instead.
Who you apparently don't trust at all.
Mm. I suppose maybe if you were, say, you had a really unpredictable child that enjoyed running off a lot and you took them somewhere like, I don't know, Disneyland.
Yes.
And you needed to keep, you know, it might be worth it, but like for a one-off.
So we thought this is a good opportunity to have a think about some of the most ridiculous wearable tech that we've come across. And the one that kind of glares out at me is a Microsoft Smart Bra that we've actually spoken about on this podcast before that was designed to combat emotional eating. And it had a kind of sensor system that sat on the bra, on the bit which sat against the rib cage, which measured essentially boob sweat and heart activity in order to detect emotional triggers for overeating. So the idea was you wear this all day and then you log what you're eating and it kind of continually monitors your mood to see how that affects the food choices that you make, with the view to then intervene. I think it provided some kind of, I think it was actually mindfulness exercises or breathing exercises.
As long as it's not an electric shock.
It wasn't an electric shock, but actually maybe that would have been a better deterrent.
Yeah, because men are overeaters, emotional overeaters as well. This is garbage to just direct it unless they've got man bras.
I know, but guys don't wear bras, so you'd have to put it somewhere else.
I don't know, t-shirt.
Maybe they need smart pants.
pelvic Speaking sweat.
I have heard of some fantastic smart pants,
yeah,
known as drum pants, and they're not actually pants in the English sense of the word. They're pants in the American sense. So they're trousers that contain sensors that you can hit, and each sensor will make a different drum sound. So you can sit, on a chair, just slapping away at your legs,
and it'll make drum sounds.
And it'll make a
sound just comes out of your pants.
Yeah,
so in the way that people like might slap their thighs in a sort of rhythmical
exactly
they'll be like, god, that person, they're so musical. When I slap my thighs, it sounds so average.
Who's the cool guy with the hi-hat on his leg?
I can imagine if you wore these to a gig, it might start getting confusing if everyone was slapping their drum pants at the same time.
Yeah, and as we're in Spain, where everyone has this amazing sense of rhythm, and they all just like jump into this kind of clapping rhythm that is so syncopated and extraordinary.
That's such an idealized vision of Spain.
It actually happened. I lived in Spain for a bit, and you'd be in a club and I can just about clap to a single beat, and Spanish people will all clap in kind of different but complementary beats, and it is amazing. But anyway, we digress.
Maybe you should have to have some kind of basic musical ability to be allowed to wear drum pants.
Yeah, you have to have a sequence of tests of slapping your thighs to see whether or not you qualify for the drum pants.
But I actually think drum pants are amazing. I really like them. Not so amazing guardian angel. We wrote about this a few weeks ago, and it's like a big fat, really cumbersome, obvious silver pendant. If you don't like it, it's just gonna be completely pointless, and most people do not like giant silver pendants. It doubles as a panic alarm though, so if you're on a bad date, you can press it and it will trigger a fake phone call so that you can say, oh gosh, emergency,
I can't just tell you that I'm hating this date. I have to have a fake call. Actually, we've discussed this before, but we do that anyway. People do that anyway with getting a friend to
phone
in.
Just text your friend. Don't slam your fist into the giant silver pendant on your chest.
Emergency.
Subtle.
Well, if you think that's unsubtle, you should take a look at the sensory girl mood sweater. Now, this is an incredibly useless piece of technology, which is basically, as you might imagine, a sweater with a sort of huge...
As in a jumper, not as in my boobs are sweaty.
Yeah,
so American
today. With a stupidly huge collar that practically comes over your chin. And it's called GER because of some technology called Galvanic Extimacy Responder, which promotes externalized intimacy.
That old thing.
And basically,
the idea is
that this nonsense technology senses what mood you're in from sensors inside the jumper and makes the collar glow a different colour. This huge thing, it's like wearing a rubber ring around your neck.
So it's like a mood ring, but your whole outfit.
But just like shouting about it.
A mood ring for your
face, basically, cupping you.
Area.
And if you don't know what a mood ring is, this is something probably more women will know than guys, but it's a ring that basically changed colour according to your temperature, and it tried to claim that the different colours meant different moods, but I think it was all a load of rubbish.
No, it's very popular with little girls in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And they all just told you it was purple. Bad mood.
But Leah, you also wrote about a piece of clothing that changed according to some data that was how much of a data trail you're leaving on the services it were using, and it went transparent.
Oh, yes.
Show your nipples.
Yes. Unfortunately, it doesn't stay transparent for long, but it basically just tracked how much location data you were giving away. Because if you think about all the apps running on your phone that are actually at the back end logging where you've been, you can go in and have a look at it, and it's kind of horrifying. But most people don't notice this. You're not aware of it, you don't bother, whatever, tick tick tick. I will sign up to this app. And this top was basically a kind of social commentary on this, and as you know, we're more technology is forcing us to give away data without thinking about it. And also you get to see boobies.
It had like electrochromic layers that would go transparent either when a current was passed through it or not passed through it, and so it could change depending on how much data you were leaving.
Very good memory. Yeah. It actually looked pretty cool as well. I quite liked it.
but again, it was targeted at women showing their breasts.
There's a lot of that, isn't there?
I asked some people on Twitter what their favourite terrible wearable technology was, and I had one comment back from Mark C saying, Nintendo's Power Glove, it's so bad.
That really is bad. Look it up if you don't know what that is.
And I had another comment from Mark Asquith, who said the smartphone cinema, and I had to look this up, and it's basically imagine wearing a cardboard box on your head with your phone stuck inside, but lying down.
Like that lying is on Google Cardboard. That's something that they proudly released to the world a few weeks ago.
This isn't even as sophisticated as that, Leah.
And this plays on the old, is it close, is it far away, or is it very small perspective trick, whereby it might look like it's just a big screen far away as opposed to a tiny screen just in front of your eyes.
Like you're in the cinema. Aww. At the very back.
What's the most ridiculous piece of wearable tech that you know about? Please do let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. The final section of this week's podcast is the feedback loop. And that is where we talk about all your comments and emails that we've received regarding previous episodes or just general wonderings about Wired.co.uk themes.
Tom Edge wrote in about something unrelated to our podcast chat, which is a nice change, who says, "Hi there, just thought I should make sure you're aware of the absolute nonsense around the Pitch 10 scheme. The idea was to give 10 startups an opportunity to pitch in front of a load of tech leaders and investors at 10 Downing Street. It's played out that the 10 companies who were selected aren't exactly cash-strapped startups. They've already collectively raised over $100 million. I won one of them is funded by a VC who was on the independent selection panel." To add lols, this morning the 500-ish people who submitted applications were all CC'd on an email from one of the bods at Downing Street. You know what tech entrepreneurs like to do? Send emails. Friggin' loads of emails. I've had to change my email notification because it sounded like RTT2 was having a seizure. Just thought you'd like to know. We did, Tom. Thank you.
We also had some really nice feedback from someone called Steve Norris Tarry, who said that the podcast on Wired is getting dangerously close to the best tech podcast around, and there's some very good ones out there. The chemistry of you three giggling with some hefty technical insight to boot at stuff going on in the tech world is very, very good, and it's getting better every week. Love the show, Steve, as they say on the self-proclaimed flagship film podcast with Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode. Yes, that's the kind of lofty podcast company I think you guys can keep these days, in my humble opinion. That is very nice of you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
That's incredibly nice, Steve.
I think that's the nicest feedback we've had over the last few weeks.
Yeah, thank you.
But we would welcome more feedback, positive and negative. We've had a lot of negative. We haven't talked about Apple recently. Maybe we should bring that back to get some more negative.
That was a downer.
So thank you very much, and we will see you next week. Bye
bye
bye.